And now, coming to you live from the depths of the internet, it's John Stevens, Fred Kish, Jeff Patterson, the Three Horsemen, with Jonathan Strahan, me, on the Three Horsemen podcast!
Yay!
What's going on?
Yes, good evening, folks. We're back once again. John DiNardo and Patrick Hester haven't figured out how to keep us off. And once again, we've gone out and lassoed another horseman to join us. I'd like everyone to say hello to Jonathan Strahan. Hello, Jonathan.
Hello.
Hello. Good to talk to you guys.
And I looked on your website today, John, which is why I... Jonathan, sorry. I'm going to get confused all throughout
it's
the show.
Okay. Yep.
I looked on your website today, and I was going to do a little thing based on your bio there, which is why I sent you a tweet saying, needs a little updating. So I think you've got a few dozen anthologies missing. But Jonathan works for both Locus and on his own as a editor of many fine anthologies, some of which we will talk to tonight, and is coming from us 12 hours in the future. So this really is a science fiction podcast.
Hey, I wanted to ask, do you have really bad morning radio in Australia?
Everywhere has really bad morning radio. Everyone's been willing to jump into a black four-wheel drive and run around and give out, you know, terrible soda while playing loud music. But yeah,
we can turn into J-Dog, the Ogre, and the Tank Man if we have to. So we can.
Why not?
No.
Good taste, probably. But yeah. But yes, it's been a while since I updated the biography. I guess I could. It falls so far down the list of things to do, though.
That's true.
And there's actually a semi-up-to-date one on Wikipedia, I guess. But yes, it's woefully out of date. So anyway, yes. Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to be here.
We're very happy to have you.
Yes.
I assume all of us, I know I am, I've been listening to the Cood Street podcast ever since, good Lord, the low single digits.
Wow.
Somewhere down there.
You've listened to far more than I have then.
Yes, a lot of rambling.
I say that to him every week.
So tonight we're going to discuss, since we have an expert on the show with us, the subject of anthologies. I mean, speaking for myself, I started out reading science fiction with the very venerable SF Book Club Anthony Boucher 2-volume set.
Ooh.
My parents would always go to various yard sales and rummage sales and garage sales and pick up whatever SFBC books they could find and give them to me for Christmas. So I think I've read that one, several dozen times. And a couple of Jeff Conklin's and the Damon Knight Science Fiction Argosy. All the way through themed anthologies like Thieves World, mm-hmm. Wild Cards, mm-hmm. and... even today, a themed anthology series called Infinity, of which we'll hear a little bit more.
Yes, though it's a little bit different from, say, the Thieves' World or that era of themed anthology, which was very specific. The kind of interesting thing, I guess. I guess I got started with anthologies in probably my early teens when I stumbled across a copy of Bob Silverberg's SF Hall of Fame, you know, the anthology he did in the late 60s for SIFWA.
Yep.
Which, I mean, I suppose up until that point, I would stumble across books of short stories and not particularly think of them as anything other than more reading. You know, there'd be that collection of stories you'd read by an author that you're already into. You know, so when you read The Pass Through Tomorrow by Heinlein, it's because you're reading more Heinlein, not because you're particularly thinking about reading short fiction. But even then, it'd be the odd anthology I'd stumble upon until I started reading Terry Carr's Best of the Year anthologies that he did. I think he did, 17 or 18 of them, ending up at Bain, of all places, if I remember correctly. And that and Damon Knight's series that he did, Orbit,
yep.
and Universe. You know, the Terry Carr books are really the ultimate. And then, if I were to pin it down to two books in the modernish era, there'd be the first of Gardner Dozois' Best of the Year anthologies that he did for Blue Jay.
Mm-hmm.
Which had a phenomenal Tom Kidd cover on it and a whole batch of spectacular stories. And the anthology that probably changed my reading more than any other, which was Michael Bishop's Light Years in Dark, which came out in 1984 and was originally, I think, going to be called something horrible like Cosmopedia or something, if I remember correctly. And introduced me to, I don't think I'd read Howard Waldrop at that time. I don't think I'd read R.A. Lafferty at that time. I don't think I'd read much in the way of, in fact, Bishop's own short stories. Just a spectacular landmark book, and changed the way I read dramatically. And then I began hunting out anthologies, hunting out short story collections, became an avid short fiction reader, you know, after that.
Now, you've been involved with Locus.
Mm-hmm.
Was that before you started professionally editing anthologies?
No, it wasn't. What had happened was, back in the early days here in Australia, I'd got caught up in what was supposed to be a fanzine and turned into a semi-prozine called Eidolon.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd done maybe 5 years of it when there was a change in Australian publishing. There was a real interest suddenly at major publisher level to publish genre fiction, and HarperCollins were starting up what became the Voyager Online, the Voyager imprint.
Right.
There was an editor, Louise Thurtell, who was responsible for it. And in their first year, one of my Eidolon co-editors and I pitched doing a Best of the Year series to HarperCollins. And we did two volumes. And in retrospect, I think they made a mistake not continuing, because the sort of sales that we had then, they would kill for now. But, you know, the world moves on, you know. So we did that for like a couple of years. And at around the same time, I'd become friends. Well, I'd met my future wife, who was at the time the managing editor for Locus.
Mm-hmm.
And via nepotism and nothing else, because she wanted me to come out and live with her for a year in Oakland, I got a job as, I think it was like, international guest editor or something like that for Locus, which is largely meant sweeping the basement. I mean, I remember when I finally traveled out to Oakland and we'd moved in, I got my first day on the job, and Charles Brown welcomed me. We'd been out to dinner a couple of times, so we knew each other a little bit. And he said, okay, and he took me down, through the library, downstairs, down through the library that's at Locus. And he went past all the rare, wonderful first editions and all that. And they went to the back room, and that was where all the magazines were, and went through all that. And they went to this area that had been dug out of the hillside. And I was like, I'm not kidding you. And it's like open like dirt. And there's like a few like wooden platforms laid on the open dirt. And in one corner, there were sort of about 60 or 80 cartons of old Locus bibliographic books.
Mm.
Yeah, because I used to publish these indexes.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And his job for the first time was, I know you can't stand up straight, but could you move them from that corner to that corner? So that was the kind of thing that I was doing as an editor. And the other sort of thing at Locus, sort of as an editor, was my job once a week was to take Charles Brown grocery shopping, because he couldn't drive himself, right? Because he had a bad eye.
Yeah.
And we had so much to do that the others would be desperate for this day to come along each week, so that he would leave them alone so they could get their jobs done. And he and I would go out for the day, and we would go out and we would grocery shop and have lunch and go CD shopping and talk about science fiction the whole time. So that was sort of like the in, if you like. And through him, I met a whole bunch of people. That's where I met Bob and Karen Silverberg, who were so important to what I did later on. All kinds of people who are friends now. And the Locus sort of thing, I think, came to a point where Charles said he was feeling a little bit there's too much to do. And he was down here in Australia. What we used to do is I would help with the recommended reading every year.
Mm-hmm.
And Charles would come down to Australia for Christmas holidays, because he had no immediate family in the Bay Area, and spent the time with us, and we would do recommended reading. And one day he sort of said, well, do you want to be the reviews editor for Locus? And I'm like, sure. And trying to work out exactly what he meant, because Charles was not good at relinquishing control on anything. So it became a very collaborative process for the first X number of years. But that was also, I think at one point he wanted me to take over the magazine maybe. And so I think it was also a way of trying to sort of bring me in a little bit closer, given that I'd moved out. And the podcast, as I think I'd explained, and you'd be familiar with, particularly Fred, having heard the early ones, the podcast was the outgrowth of the conversations Charles and I would have every week about science fiction. I mean, I would call him up every weekend for at least an hour, if not two or three, and we'd talk about gossip in the field, what was happening, what we were reading, what was interesting, what was happening, all this sort of stuff. And when Charles passed away, Gary and I picked up the conversations, I guess, and led to the podcast. But really, I only ever got a job at Locus because I was sleeping with the managing editor. and I had been editing beforehand, yes, though I guess it really became serious once I started working for Locus. In fact, a bit after, after I became reviews editor, it was 2003. And I know why. It was after 2003 that all of the anthologies that I've done since really took off.
Mm. Wow.
All right. There you go.
There you go, kids. No MFA, no writers program.
Well, I actually, you know, like you joke about it, but it's actually a good point you make, because I was talking to somebody, a friend of mine yesterday, no, last week, Elisa Krasnstein, was doing some paperwork for a grant, right? And it had to do with qualifications as an editor. And she sort of pinged me and was like, what the heck are they talking about?
Right.
And now within the arts environment, I guess, you know, there are qualifications you can get as an editor. But everybody I know who's ever worked as a professional editor in science fiction did it through just on-the-job experience, walking in, becoming a lowly paid intern or whatever it might be, and working their way up over time. You know, doing it is the only training that there is.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
Hey, I had a question. Your introduction to Reacher Infinity was probably one of the most informative introductions when it came to pinning down a theme for a book. You know, so many introductions that I read to anthologies tend to be, hi, I love this particular aspect of, and then they go into whatever the slice of science fiction that they're trying to leverage to greater extent was. But the introduction to this one, you really talk about the, what's the word I'm looking for? I guess the angle of approach that you're trying to take to the subject matter. And could you just give us a little brief thing about how you decided to come to that direction?
Well, the Infinity books all happened by chance. I mean, if you go through and you read the introductions of them, you'll see, you know, I think I say, you know, it started off as a bar conversation at a convention, you know, at one point, about just doing a hard SF book. And really, Engineering Infinity was just let's do a hard SF book with, you know, new writers, see what we get. And it happened to fall into largely medium to far future stuff, stuff to do with interstellar travel. And I'd been reading, you know, James Corey, that kind of thing. So the Edge of Infinity book, which is much more, you know, sort of within our solar system, pre-solar flight, and which I think is actually a really core, a great core science fiction thing for right now.
Yes.
But I was looking for, with Reach for Infinity, the next thing to do, what made sense. And, you know, given that it all happened organically, it was like, well, okay, well, now, you know, this third book was not going to be done organically. What makes sense to fit, you know, the far future, the mid future? Well, obviously near future is what kind of makes sense. And to some degree, the book isn't exactly that. And I'm aware, I mean, a number of reviewers have pointed out that not all the stories fit very very precisely into this intended mode of us getting off the planet and in into space. But it seemed to fit that there was this logical progression in the kinds of stories you could tell, the kinds of environments for stories that existed that we could use, and that they would give a sort of cycle to these books, particularly these three. You know, it becomes, you know, a bit trickier the further on we go, and we're looking to the, you know, the next book and all that kind of thing. But for Reach for Infinity, it was sort of like, okay, well, let's lay out in the introduction, what are we going to do? We're going to talk about this period of time. This is why. Because science fiction is sort of struggling, as we've talked about often before on Coot Street. It's atomizing. And now there's this sort of this idea of core science fiction, and to some degree, to a great degree, the Infinity books are core science fiction. So it's what are the stories that core science fiction has to tell? What's the purpose of it still? And it is looking to the future and trying to see what it can say about today. And so the closer to the present you come is a really interesting and difficult thing for science fiction to do. It's why so many stories are set in the mid to far future. Mm. And so the idea with Reach was to try and wrangle with that a little bit. And I'm going to come around again at it up from a slightly different angle with the next book. But I think that it's really rich storytelling territory. And some, you know, some of the authors really come to terms that I think pretty well.
Yeah, for me, it's nice to see the shorter form, because two of my favorite anthologies were both novelette and novella ones. One was Godlike Machines, which was yours, and 1 Million AD by Gardner. And I really liked the widescreen aspect of both of them. And the Infinity books have done something similar, but in smaller bites, which is quite refreshing once in a while. So,
Well, you know, I mean, it's one of those sort of archetypal sort of statements that science fiction is really well suited to novella length. And, you know, for all that everybody says there aren't many markets for novellas out there anymore, you know, they're growing. Unfortunately for the Science Fiction Book Club, I think the novella length anthologies they did were varyingly successful.
Yeah.
I mean, as evidenced by the fact that we never actually got a trade edition of Godlike Machines out there. Mm. But I think the book came together really, really well. I think Al Reynolds' story in there was terrific. Greg Egan's was, you know. So, you know. And something I want to do more. I'm working on some novella stuff quietly in the background at the moment. So,
nice.
You know. Yeah. And, of course, with the tour.com announcement that you guys would be familiar with, where they're going into, you know, novella publication, you know, there's a lot of room to expand there. So,
right.
Now, when you pitch the idea to your publisher, I mean, I assume contact authors. Do you just do open submissions, or do you have a? Okay. I mean, there are some people that you've used several times. You know,
I've got a stable of people I go
right,
to.
Like, I mean, oddly enough, Cory Doctorow. Every time I've read one of his stories in your anthologies, I hear him talking because I've heard his podcast so many times.
Well,
no other story does that for me.
I've got a few people who are like that. I mean, a few people I've heard read stories, and when they are talented readers of their own work, as there are a few people out there, then it really does stick with you. There's a few where, I mean, I remember many years ago going to a convention here in Perth, and CJ Cherry was the guest of honor. And you, Fred, I think we're talking about, you know, sort of that period theme anthologies. And she was in the Janet Morris edited Hell series of anthologies.
Yes. Oh, yep.
Ah.
Heroes in Hell and...
Yeah, and she'd written a story for Kings in Hell, and that was what she did for her reading at the convention. And I love Cherry's work, really adore it. And it was terrible. I mean, it was a terrible, terrible reading. Very flat, affectless. And you're just going, this is dreadful. You know, so, but with, I guess your question is like, what's the process I go through to put together an anthology?
Right.
You know, like, and it varies a little, but say for like a book, like the Infinity books, I'll talk to the publisher up front about the idea that I have. Quite often I will write a 2 or 3 page proposal to them about what the space for the book, what it's going to do, the kind of writers that I hope to involve. And depending on the scale of the book, I will actually go out to all the authors up front and ask them to commit to being part of it and see if they're interested. And that allows me to give them a list of people who are going to be part of it. Because generally the majority of my original anthologies have been invitation only. So I write out to people about a year in advance and say, would you be willing to write a story for me? And they'll come back and say, please give us more money. And then yes. And then I say, sure. And then every month or two, I send them an email going, don't forget, you promised to give me a story. And then... you know, hopefully I've been smart enough to build a month or two sort of slack in there so that when I don't deliver, I can find other people, as often happens, sadly. and then you sort of put together the stories. It's only a couple of times. I think the last full open submission anthology that I did was Eidolon 1 with Jeremy Byrne, where we just invited anybody to send. And I'd like to. The real barrier to it, as anybody who's done it could tell you, is it's phenomenally time-consuming. You know, you end up getting, I think the last time we did it, we got 700 or 800 submissions.
Right. Wow.
Right.
And I would expect these days to get more than that. And you've got to also have a publisher that's willing to take that commercial risk, because there's no way of guaranteeing who you're going to get into that book. It would be nice to have, some big names submit, but generally they don't. So you need to sort of go out there and actually shake the tree a bit. But it's always, and even that's an anxiety sort of ridden procedure. First of all, getting people to agree to submit, and then seeing if they actually will, and then seeing whether, you know, you actually will get something good. I mean, I think one of the most terrifying things I had happen was when Ted Chiang agreed to submit for Eclipse 2. And Ted doesn't really tell you what he's going to do, which fitted Eclipse pretty well because it was on-themed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the email hit my inbox, and you know, you go to open it, and you're going, have I got the first ever terrible Ted Chiang story? You know, because, you know, it could happen. And then, you know, if you've got the first terrible Ted Chiang story, what do you do? Do you sit there and send him back 400 pages of notes? Do you reject it, or do you go, well, the world's going to want to read a Ted Chiang story, even a terrible one. In fact, the sheer novelty of a terrible Ted Chiang story might drive more people to buy the book than, you know, a good one would, you know. And obviously the same thing happens when you're dealing with bigger name writers. And in one or two rare, a couple of instances, you know, I've had situations where, you know, like when I did the Starry Rift for Viking Children's back in the mid-2000s, you know, there were some people they really wanted in the book. So there was a lot of pressure to make sure that worked, that the stories were good, and I'd contractually agreed to it. So, you know, that's one of the variations on it that you can end up being a little bit hamstrung and having to go along with stuff that you can't really afford the time for, or that, you know, maybe might not work out. But generally, it works out really well. I mean, one of the best experiences I've had recently was when I was doing the second Fearsome book, you know, Fearsome Magics. Mm-hmm. And Robert Shearman, you know, the English writer, had sent me this story, and I'm reading it and I'm going, yeah, this isn't really that great. And Rob kind of emailed me a few days later. He's going, well, what do you think? I said, well, he said, you don't sound like you really like it. And I'm like, well, you know, like, it's all right. And we can probably, he said, don't worry, I'll write you another story. And I'm going, we're a week past the deadline. I've got to get the whole book in 2 weeks. A week later, he delivered me this story, which is the best story I've read all year. And if it's not on award, you know, ballots, I will eat my hat, you know. Yeah. It totally deserves to be there. So,
right.
But you can't predict that, so it's a strange game.
Yep. Yeah. And when you'll get the stories delivered, hopefully without too much of a overage of the deadline, and then you've got this pile of stories. So how do you then form them into a book? Because there are obviously like Harlan Ellison's Medea, if you're familiar with that one.
I am. Yeah.
It kind of is over a time frame. Same with like Thieves World, the first couple of books, they were telling a story. But your episodes or your anthologies are not exactly that same sort of thing, but you do want to kind of structure things a certain way.
Sure, sure. I mean, the Medea book, if I recall correctly, actually grew out of a symposium that they did.
Yeah,
and right. they were deliberately putting together a kind of a meta novel kind of a thing. And there was certainly that with some of the Thieves World stuff and some of the Heroes and Hell stuff. And if I recall, the Merovingian Knights did it. And
so did the
Wild Cards books, very much so. Particularly the first one, which was really great. But I've not had the right kind of an idea to actually put together that kind of single coherent narrative. Maybe you need to be more of an author yourself to do it. I know that Lou Anders and I sort of knocked an idea together around at one point to do something along those lines. But for me, I've tended to do standalone stories that are only at best loosely thematically related. So, you know, you begin to sort of, what you have to assume is that anybody will read your book from opening to closing and not skip around. Now, of course, they will, but you can't plan for that. So it's like, okay, let's assume you'll read it. You'll need an introduction. You may want story notes, whatever else. And then there's the whole rhythm and flow of it. So you've got these stories that have come in. You've accepted them. If you've had any thought at all in your head what you've done along the way is you've edited them as you go, so you don't have to do them all in the short period of time before you deliver the manuscript. And now you've got anywhere from 12 to 18 or so stories sitting in a pile and trying to work out how do they work together thematically, how do they work in terms of pacing, how do they work in terms of voice, how do they work in terms of length. So, you know, I'll sit there and you mean like, and I'll think, okay, well, I want someone to be invited into a book. I want them to be engaged by it. So I'm going to look for a story that's very approachable, but is very much core to the theme of the book to open with always. So that when you get through the introduction, when you've looked at the cover, you've bought the book, you've read the introduction, and you read that first story, you feel like, yep, I know where I am. I'm on solid ground. You know, there's a big honking spaceship on the cover. He talked about spaceships in the introduction, and lo and behold, there's a spaceship right in the first story. And probably for the first story or two, you want to keep to that kind of pace, and then something, you know, you throw something in to sort of vary it up to show people that you're not going to just do strictly exactly what they expect.
Mm-hmm.
Because that makes it more rewarding. Mm-hmm. You're also not going to start with anything too dark up front, something too dense. I mean, I remember one time Gardner Dezois and I were doing the table of contents for the New Space Opera 1, I think it was. And originally we were going to open with the Greg Egan story that's in that book, which I think is a terrific story. But as the editor we were dealing with at the publishing house said, very dense and perhaps would put some people off. And so we reshuffled. The other things I tend to put the longer stories and, usually at the back of the book. You know, the basic tentpole has always been supposed to be best story at the beginning, second best story at the end, third best story in the middle. The idea being that they come in there, a reader is rewarded at the beginning, but when they hit the middle, they're encouraged to keep going, and at the end of something, when they put the book down, they feel like it's great. The problem with that is I don't think that it really actually reflects how people read and is not the best way to go about it. So, yeah, I sit there with manuscripts and I make lists. I make spreadsheets, and I've got descriptions of the theme of the story. I've got word counts, and I will sit there and I'll juggle the list around until I begin to think that it looks like a reasonable list. And then once I've got to a point where I'm happy with the way it looks, I'll actually put together a copy of the manuscript and read the book. And if anything throws me out, if I suddenly realize that I've put three science fiction baseball stories together or something, then I'll begin to reshuffle. And these sort of things happen every now and again. I mean, and sometimes you can be completely oblivious. I mean, the great example to me was when Jeremy Byrne and I did the Year's Best Australian Science Fiction and Fantasy Volume 2 in 1997. And we put it together. We were really happy with it. We delivered it to the editor. And our editor came back and said, "Do you realize all these stories are about kinky sex?" and we're like, no, we didn't notice that any of them were about kinky sex, really. And then, of course, once it had been pointed out, you're going, it's the only thing you can see in the book, right?
Right. Can't see
And now it's under, we need to move this around, we need to make that less obvious, we need to do this. But that hasn't happened very often. Usually, the rhythm and flow works pretty well. I also have to be completely honest. Dedicated anthology readers look for these patterns themselves, how the editor has put this stuff together. And sometimes they manage to perceive more structure than is actually there.
Mm-hmm.
Every now and again, a book just falls together. And I've had one or two fall together and somebody come along and go, just the resonance between these stories is fantastic. And the time he must have put in to get it all right. And you're going, sure, yes, absolutely. That's exactly what I did.
So it sounds like making a mixtape, actually. So
it's an awful lot like making a mixtape. It's an excellent analogy, yes, because you're basically reading a book is a very personal thing to do anyway. So you're putting this batch of tracks that you love together and giving it to someone so they've got this experience they can go through, and they're going to experience it completely by themselves, really. And so it is. It's exactly like that. And remembering that, I think, helps understand what's being done, rather than worrying about how it sort of influences the history of science fiction, I think.
Mm. Wow. Shall we talk about some favorite anthologies and give Jonathan a moment to rest his voice?
Sure.
Well, he is talking to us from tomorrow, so yes, he does need to recoup.
Well, John, would you like to mention some favorites?
There are a lot. It's mentioning Terry Carr at the start there suddenly just brought vividly to my mind the fact that I think I discovered a lot of the authors that I came to read and sort of became seminal authors for me in his anthologies, Orbit and Universe particularly. And I think some of those, I think it might have been Universe 7, where I first read Gene Wolfe, for example. And the story that was in there just took me, And what I'm trying to get at is that when I think of my favorite anthologies, I don't often think first of the ones that have the best stories in them, the ones that most influenced subsequent reading.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, the Terry Carr stuff, and it's really funny, and I was sitting here listening to Jonathan talk, it just occurred to me that as a way of planting seeds in me as a reader, and to some extent as a writer, anthologies have actually been very important. Because some of them, like the Carr books and even some of the best of Year's Best and stuff, give you a feeling for what's out there in terms of what people consider to be well-written stories, what kind of themes are interesting to explore and such. and then the more thematically organized ones. And then we have several different types. We have the shared world style, and then we have this just, you know, the sort of story theme stuff. Those things also, I think, gave me ideas about, you know, how would I write for this? Like, looking at a themed anthology, how would I write for this? What is it about this subject that interests me the most? And when you find a story in the anthology that actually sort of reflects that back at you, it's a big deal. In fact, I think I found that, if a story with a particular theme, an anthology with a particular theme that doesn't have something in there that does that for me, doesn't feel quite as engaging as one where I like find that story that suddenly makes me go, whoa, you know, now I understand really what's really interesting about this idea. And sometimes it gives me something to reflect back on, maybe in terms of my life or the world around me, or sometimes it, you know, springs an idea that I have in my head for writing. And that seems to, I sort of read anthologies looking for those gems in mind. Like, I don't know if I consider myself an anthology reader necessarily, like someone who voraciously goes after them. And quite honestly, there are a lot of anthologies I have not finished reading because I read three or four stories. And if something doesn't grab me, it's like, do I want to keep slogging? Well, maybe so-and-so's story will grab me, or et cetera. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So thinking about favorite anthologies, it was hard to come up with specific ones immediately because I ended up having this long conversation in my head about what an anthology means to me. And as soon as Jonathan mentioned Terry Carr, I just had this flashback to, you know, all of these anthologies of his where I found some of the authors that I loved. And it would be great if some of the current sort of year's best and sort of more openly themed books can do that for readers today, where they find someone, they find an author that they hadn't experienced before, and they can go on and go find them. And then the funny part was, I was thinking about that, I was like, you know, I found all these great authors like, you know, Dish and Gene Wolfe and who else I read? Like Ursula Le Guin, I think I encountered in one of those anthologies, etc. And then I thought, you know, what are the other anthologies that I read that was sort of seminal to my development? And it's going to be funny to say this, but the Flashing Sword, Sword and Sorcery anthologies were actually a really big deal to me when I was younger. And I read most of those when they first came out. And there were a lot of terrible stories in them. A lot of terrible stories.
Well, that was Lynn Carter.
It was Lynn Carter.
He never met a story he wouldn't want to publish.
Including his own. Including putting his own stories. Yeah, well, you know. It's like, you know, that, what was the name of that tall barbarian who beat people to death with a brass staff? But I, like, in the very first Flashing Swords anthology, that's the, like, I think it's the lead story. It's like, story by Lynn Carter. Welcome to my anthology. I'm going to write a story for it first. But when I was trying to think of, you know, favorite anthologies, that's not what came to you right away. It wasn't like, what were the ones that had the best stories in them? And then I thought, you know, a little bit more about it. And then I had a really hard time up with sort of favorite anthologies. I can certainly talk about the stuff that I read in the last week or two for the podcast. And the two that I actually got, at least most of them all the way through, were Children of Old Leech, which I'm reading for review for SF Signal, which is edited by Ross Lockhart and Justin Steele. And then the Women Destroy Science Fiction anthology from Lightspeed, which I actually read a good chunk of today.
I think a little breakup, John.
Yeah, a lot of wind.
Sorry.
Okay.
How are you reading women?
I'm terrible. I drifted in front of my fan here. I've turned off the fan.
Yeah, we'll throw some water on you when you faint.
Thank you. When you hear that big thud, just, you know, cut my mic for a little while. So you hear my groaning in the background.
Are you reading Women Destroy Science Fiction in paper or electronically?
I'm reading it in paper, baby.
It's a
wow.
Fat. Book, isn't it?
I killed a beetle with it last night.
John Paul, George, or Ringo.
Ah!
I called him Smiley. Yes, I heard this weird rustling noise at my desk while I was typing, and all of a sudden this beetle just popped out and was like, "Hey, how you doing?" I was like, "Ah, bam!"
I can
tell you that light speed can penetrate the armor of a beetle that's about the size of your thumbnail. In case you need to gauge for future insect, you know, defense, that's about how it works. So you know, I was thinking about these and a couple of other anthologies that I've read recently. I was trying to think of anthologies that I'd read of Jonathan's, and the first one that popped in my head weirdly was Swords and Dark Magic, which you edited with Lou Anders.
Yeah.
Which is one of those collections where I read the first three or four stories, like, that's okay, that's not bad, nah, that's fine. And then one, I think it was the CJ Cher story, just like hit me in the face, and I was like, whoa, because that is such a good story of hers. Yeah. It's very understated, and it almost doesn't seem to, for a large part of it, to belong in sort of a sword swinging anthology. But it ended up being just a fantastic story, and then I read the rest of the anthology, and it was actually some great stuff in there. And see, that's one of those anthologies I walked in with a little bit of trepidation because it was a very broad theme. It's just, you know, sword and sorcery. I'm like, yay, so are we going to get, you know, 15 Lynn Carter stories, or, you know, are we going to get 15 Michael Moorcock stories? And we got a mix. But like I said, when I get part of the way through an anthology, if something doesn't leap out and grab me, it's hard to keep going because I just feel like at that point, and this may dovetail with Jonathan's idea of how you decide what to lead with, try to get something that's not too dark or not too long that'll pull the readers in. And I kind of feel if that doesn't happen for me sometimes, it's hard to keep going. But The Children of Old Leech, the first story in that one, which was a Gemma Files story, didn't grab me until I was done reading it and went back to think about it. Because it's these are all, you know, stories in honor of Laird Barron. So there's no lighthearted stories in here. There are no frolics in this book. They're all really dark. And, you know, some may be a little darker than others, but, you know, it's muted moonlight versus complete blackness is sort of the range of darkness we're dealing with here. But it ended up being, I thought, a good choice because it had the classical elements of sort of Lovecraftian-influenced fiction, but there was something else going on at the same time. And that was intriguing enough to pull me in. And the next couple stories didn't grab me as much, but... There are some really good stories in here. Gemma Files' story is quite good. Molly Tanzer's story was great. Michael Sisko's, of course, made you scratch your head for 10 minutes after you read it to wonder what you had just read. And I actually went back and reread it. But that one was quite good, too. And John Lanigan has a goodly length story in here as well that had his usual, you know, superb literary chops in it. And that anthology, you know, the quote-unquote theme is people sort of playing in Laird Barron's sandbox, basically, his literary sandbox. And while I felt that some of the writers could have stretched that a little bit more, I thought the strongest stories actually did a great job of balancing, sort of being in sort of Laird's imagination, but going somewhere else that the author wanted to go. Those kind of anthologies seem to maybe be the biggest kind of juggling act, maybe for an editor as well as for the author. These kind of tributes where you're going into someone's, you know, sort of story world and trying to not make it your own and not just produce something that's a sort of, you know, fanboyish copy. But actually trying to use that material to create something new and interesting, a new and interesting story. So it didn't work with all the authors, but when I was thinking about what makes an anthology work and thinking about the podcast tonight, I thought it mostly worked because some of the authors didn't take great chances, but they really did try to find something interesting that maybe hadn't been explored yet in that, and kind of ran with it. And then briefly, just the Lightspeed anthology isn't something very different. This the Lightspeed anthology's theme is here are a bunch of stories that are science fiction, and they're written by women. But there's no, it's not a thematized really at all. I mean, there's the sort of half humorous women destroy science fiction subtitle, but the stories are whatever people wanted them to be. I mean, there's a wide range of stories in it. The best stories in that one, really were just, since there's no hewing to theme, just the best written stories are what really leapt out to me. And, the two that I would recommend out of that off the top of my head would probably be Amal Al-Muhtar's story, basically about diamond mining in the solar system. And N.K. Jemisin writes a great story that's sort of a puppet master style story that goes in an interesting direction at the end. And that one for me was a little harder to keep going through because after a couple stories didn't really work for me. I wasn't sure what I would see next, but once I had read N.K. Jemisin's story, I actually plowed on because I was curious to kind of see what happened next. And I haven't read all the nonfiction yet, but I read the fiction portion and some of the flash, and it was pretty good.
Cool.
So,
how about you, Jeff?
Well, I was listening to John talk and thinking about my little history, and after I had done the Dangerous Visions books, and I was far too young to be reading those, I'll tell you that. I dove into every volume of Damon Knight's Orbit that I could find, and that was probably the first one that I was reading on a regular basis. I found most of those used in my younger days. The ones that probably laid me out flat the most when I first read them, even though I was a subscriber to Omni from almost the first issue, and even though I read every story in there, when they started putting out the Best of Omni Science Fiction volumes, which were pretty thick anthologies for the time, I would grab each one and I would read them cover to cover. And it hadn't struck me that I was, you know, reading an anthology of stories I had already read, but seeing them compiled in such a way really, they really struck home to me. And then they also did the thing called, I think it was just called, it might have also been called Best of Omni Science Fiction. It was the big magazine-sized books that they did. And they had a lot of art on the inside and stuff like that. And once again, that was sort of a winnowed down, really rarefication of the kind of stuff that they were doing. For ones that have gone after that, I recently reread Mike Ashby's Mammoth Book of Comic Fantasy, the first volume. I'm going to reread the other two in a bit. I had not read that in probably since it came out. And I remember I was kind of so-so when it first came out, but my exposure to these two gentlemen and everybody over at SF Signal has gotten me out of my comfort zone. So I reread these stories from with a completely fresh set of critical eyes. And it is a very good anthology. I'm waiting to dive into the next two. And the other one that kind of really struck me home recently, I had this book for a while, but had not read it. And it was a reprint anthology, Women of Wonder, by Pamela Sargent.
Yes.
The classic years, 40s to 70s. And that came out in 95. And once again, this is an example of if an anthology has one or two really good stories, it takes up such a beloved place in my heart. This anthology did have Faults Down by Chelsea Quinn Yarbrough, which is possibly one of my favorite shorter works by her. And I had forgotten how much I really, really loved that story until I reread it. And now I want to go back and read the rest of her shorter stuff. Another example of anthologies having tentpoles would be Jonathan's New Space Opera 2, because it had the Robert Charles Wilson at the beginning and the John C. Wright at the end, and I love both of those stories so much that it's like the rest of the book, you know, will slide. Even though there's a lot of really good stories in there, I always go back to those two. Those two just strike me. They're so unique in the way they take stuff. I look at the Solaris anthologies, and I look at a lot of the themed ones that we've done, and especially the the really specific themed ones that that Gardner did, hand over fist for so many years, and once again recently with the what's it called, Dead Man's Hand, the John Joseph Adams Weird West one. That's another one where it's like it's fun to just read a pile of stories basically on one given subject if you know that's what you're getting into. And, you know, if you were to do like what Jonathan said, you pick up an anthology that looks like it's throwing a very wide net, and you go into it and every single story is about kinky sex. Well, then yeah, I'm going to have a bit of a problem with that. But if I'm going in reading a book about, you know, elderly werewolves, then I'm expecting, I want to see how many different takes, you know, one can have without getting bored by the topic. But yeah, most of the, just about every original anthology that comes out, I try to get my hand on. And something that does annoy me that just dawned on me is the way anthologies are done on bookshelves. Back in the day when Borders was around, Borders for a while was doing it by the editor's last name,
right?
Putting it in with everything else. And then Barnes & Noble started doing it at the front of the science fiction section. And then for a little while, they did it at the end of the science fiction section near all the licensed material. And it's really frustrating. And it's even worse when you're trying to go through a used bookstore, because a really good used bookstore will have, you know, anthologies, you know, clumped together. We have McKay's Books down here in Manassas, Virginia, and they do a wonderful job. They have one section of just anthologies. But bookstore, and quite frankly, so do Amazon and BNN Online and stuff like that. It gets tough to actually hunt down, unless you're searching for a specific title. I find it very hard to go in and say, hi, what new anthologies are out? I'd really like to see.
I fight with my boss all the time about this in our used bookstore. Because he's like, yeah, just put them with the Star Wars books. I'm like, that's not what they are. They're something different. It's like, well, they're not novels, so they should go at the end with the Doctor Who books.
I'm actually kind of curious, Jonathan, has there ever been any feedback from publishers and stuff like that about exactly how they market these things, or how they plan to label them or anything like that?
About in terms of accreditation, not really. No, I mean, most of them when they talk to you are pretty clear they're going to you know accredit them to you, but when they end up on somewhere like Amazon, say particularly, it'll be the three most significant contributors will get their names tagged them rather than the editors. I think publishers are a little bit thrown about how to handle the matter, really, because they have a diverse range of authors and they want to promote them as best they can and to market to help sell the book. But, you know, editors are largely, you know, how to put it, I always used to say there are people who are in the band and there are people who are with the band.
Yeah.
and editors are with the band by and large, you know what I mean? They're not the actual performers. You're not there to sort of, you know, as much as you may love anthology that someone puts together, it's because of the authors they present, not because of them, that's something the editor does themselves. So I think it's tricky to balance, but, you know, sort of,
yeah,
publishers really
right.
struggle, you know. They struggle to come up with covers for anthologies because they're, particularly if they're generally themed. I mean, again, your Thieves' World kind of thing is pretty straightforward. But people weren't reading Thieves' World because Lynn Abbey and Janet Morris happened to edit it, you know.
Right.
They're reading Thieves' World because they wanted to read the kind of those kind of stories, and hopefully the group of authors who were regular to them. I know places where they filed them under T for Thieves' World.
Yeah.
You know?
Yep.
Where there was no reference to anything that the editor had done.
Yeah.
And I remember going into Borderlands in California, Borderlands bookstore, which is a great bookstore. And the anthologies were all shunted down the end, alphabetical by title.
Yeah, so, you know, I found a lot of libraries that do that. The library that's near me, I found Year's Best under Y, and I found the first Solaris anthology under S, but the second one, because Solaris wasn't the first word in the title, it was somewhere else in the thing, and it becomes a bit of a mess. So they do tend to get swept under the rug.
It's all you can. If you go along with it, you hope people find the book, you know, find books, and that's all you can hope.
Yeah.
Well, I've already mentioned many of the ones I've got started with. I'll just mention a couple oddities that have been key. Like Jonathan's colleague, Mr. Wolf, I like to read a lot of nonfiction. And one editor I look for is a guy named Thomas D. Clareson, C-L-A-R-E-S-O-N, who I first came across in a collection called SF, The Other Side of Realism. And I'm like, wait a minute, this is not stories. This is essays about the things I read. So ever since I read that one, I've looked for his other books or Samuel R. Delaney's books, you know, only by him, but of course, you know, essays. Then even mixed anthologies such as Sky Life or others. Sky Life was about space habitats, and that was Greg Benford and George Zabrowski editing. You know, those are all good ones to look for, I think. And then you've got, of course, if you're keeping the single authors, I mean, Stanislaw Lem has a collection of essays. There's a collection of interviews just on William Gibson that I'm reading now. That's pretty good. Barry Malzberg has an interesting book called Breakfast in the Ruins. Then there's a collection of essays called Storming the Reality Studio, which is just about cyberpunk, and that's like as key, I think, as, say, the Mirror Shades anthology that Sterling edited in building that subgenre. So there's a ton, and when we get to Culture Consumed, I'll mention all the ones I read recently.
Hey, the other one I wanted to mention real quick that I went back and reread was Going Interstellar by Les Johnson and Jack McDevitt, which had not only stories, but it also had a lot of essays like you were talking about. And the whole book had kind of a throwback 70s analog feel. You know, it had a, although it didn't quite, you know, embrace the consensus future, it certainly did give you that type of vibe of coming off a story and then reading a rather humorous essay about a, you know, potential piece of technology, et cetera.
Well, I will point out that's from Bain, and it does not feature prominent female on the cover.
Yep.
It's got spaceships.
Yep.
So, Jonathan, would you like to say anything else about the anthology process in general? Or what?
Well, I mean, I don't know if there's much else to say. It's a matter of being a reader and applying what you read in a reasonable kind of a way, I guess, you know, trying to become a better reader so that you can give some kind of feedback to writers, because there is that sort of part, you know, thing you're expected to do, being aware of what other anthologists are doing, and keeping track of the ones that have influenced you. I mean, listening to you talk about, you know, your favorite, you know, your best, you know, the anthologies that have impacted on you most, and I'm thinking, going, well, yes, I've read that one. Yes, I've read that one. What about, you know, this one? You know, I mean, obviously, Light Years and Dark is one that I've championed off and on over the years. But, you know, if you look at things like, say, In the Field of Fire, which is Jack Dan's,
yes.
Vietnam mythology, which is spectacular, or oddities like, I don't know if you guys read Ripper, which was the Jack Dan Gardezoir Jack the Ripper anthology, which sounds gimmicky, but is actually stunningly good and has some incredible stories, including a really, really great one by Lucia Shepherd that I don't think was ever reprinted anywhere else. And so, you know, yeah, there's some really good odd anthologies, you know, and then there'll be single volumes of things. I think there's one of the Donald Walheim Best of the Years that reprinted Harlan Ellison's Paladin of the Lost Hour, which was really, really, really a good, you know, a well put together anthology in the fact that it was varied and had great rhythm, but also had, as I think you were saying, John, I think earlier, that little group of stories that you remember for years and years afterwards. You know, and the average story, an average story in an anthology that has three or four great stories in it, seems better than an average story surrounded just by other average stories.
Yeah,
you know, it's an oddity of reading. So,
yep, that's true.
But no, not much else to say about it. Reading about anthologies, really, at the moment. I'm like in the middle of, I'm in my hiatus from actually putting together anthologies right now. So.
We drag you into this discussion.
So. No. I'm very happy to have the discussion, but it's just an odd thing about my year that once the Best of the Year is delivered, and, you know, as it happened, I had another couple of originals to get done. I now don't have to do anything anthology-wise deliberately until about December, I guess. I'm reading constantly, but other than that, I have flexibility, which is great. And I'm actually reading a novel or two just for sheer mad abandon.
Whoa.
That's insane.
Well, speaking of reading, I mean, this year, and this has happened a couple times in the past, the Hugos did not nominate a full slate of short stories. So you look at that and you say, well, why is that? Is it because there's not enough good stories, or there's not enough stories? And I think, I mean, you and Gary discussed the peak short stories, you know, mm-hmm. Hubert's peak, as in peak oil. And I look at it that we've got, we're past the era of scarcity, and then we've got just too much. You can't get, I think, you need 5% of the nominating in order to get nominated. You just can't get 5% for any enough stories because there's so many stories out there. I mean, I think I've got 12 subscriptions right now, mm-hmm. you know, all online except for Analog, which has been paper since 1977. But I think I've got 12 subscriptions for periodicals, just periodicals.
Yes.
Right.
I mean, are we in a boom that's going to go, you know, burst? Can this is this just a symptom of the overall fracturing of the field? Any thoughts out there?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's no doubt there's more short stories being published today than ever have been before. You know, over the last 10 or 15 years, the sheer quantities of short fiction being published has exploded, and the way it's used in the marketplace has changed. You know, back when I started reading, when I first started reading magazines, when I bought my first issue of Nova before it became Omni, when I bought Asimov's when it first came out, when I started buying FNSF, you know, there was a very core market for short fiction to be published in. It was very clear, and it was a very strong commercial business model, you know, behind it. I mean, I don't know if the magazines were ever spectacularly profitable during my lifetime, but at least they were solid businesses. I mean, Omni was selling close to 1 million copies of each issue. I think that at one point when I came along,
wow.
I mean, certainly, Asimov's were selling 25,000 copies or so. I think at one point, Analog may have been high as 60,000 or 70,000 copies.
Right.
So it was doing really well, and so short fiction was valued in a clear market. Now short fiction is valued, but it doesn't have a clear market. There are all kinds of places that run on non-commercial models. I mean, places like Tor.com who publish top-ranked short fiction, pay a lot of money for it, get it out to an audience, but it's largely done for promotional purposes. It itself doesn't raise any revenue. You've got models that we talked about before we went live, about like Daily Science Fiction, who put out a story every weekday, and yet there's no clear commercial model. Those things could stop at any time. They're not stable. Mm. So you've got a less commercially stable marketplace. You've got stories being used for all kinds of different purposes now. You know, it's quite common for authors to use short fiction for promotional purposes. You know, I'll put out my new novel and I'll drop a related short story in it. I know that when my friend Sean Williams put out his novel Twinmaker, he wrote a related original Twinmaker short story for each of the international editions of the book that came out.
Wow.
Yeah. I remember when Patrick Ness republished, they did a fresh reprint edition of his trilogy. And he put a new short story in each of those for that current printing. Mm. And they're never offered for sale. They're never widely promoted, so you may not know that they existed, but they were done. When Garth Nix did A Confusion of Princes, he did the same thing. It's not uncommon. And you get it on websites. I mean, James Clory wrote quite a few stories for Orbit Short Fiction because that's seen as a way of promoting things. The reader's quandary is, how do I find it? How do I know it's any good? Exactly. Because the other thing that's happened along the way has been self-publishing has become much more accessible, much more acceptable, and the various methods of getting your work out have changed. Putting short story, I was talking to a friend of mine who said, oh, they might write a series of short stories and just chuck it on their blog because they could. Yeah. And I've talked to other friends who are sort of going, well, I can put it up as a Kindle single, I can whatever it is. So you can't find it. It's vastly more quantity. And people are pushing for more and more diversity in the field, which is a unalloyed good. But one of the side effects of it is there's this broader range of stuff and nobody's reading the same thing. And it's actually, I guess, a spin-off of where popular culture is today, you know. Everybody isn't experiencing the same stuff in the same way they did when I went to high school. you know. In 1977, right. You know, there was the same top 40. There was the same, yeah. I don't know, 800 books in the local bookstore. And everybody could sit around and you watch the same TV show and you'd all talk about it because everybody watched the same thing last night because you had no other choice. Now, you know, we can be watching three different TV shows in the same house with none of us ever watching the same thing. My friends may be reading stuff that came from Bane or Dore, and I might be reading something else completely different, and there's no intersection. So yeah, I mean, the challenge for, you know, the Hugos, I think, is they're almost certainly going to have to revisit the 5% rule, which I think when it came in made perfect sense.
Yeah.
But now, where, you know, you just cannot simply get enough people reading the same stuff. I mean, one of my major jobs for Locus every year is to work on compiling the Locus Short Fiction Recommended Reading List. And the process is pretty much how you think it would be if you were to devote any thought to it at all, which is, you know, we pick 12, 14 people who read in the field. We get them to make recommendations. We go back and forth and we work up a list with the Locus's very short fiction reviewers, Rich Horton, Gardner Dozois, and Lois Tilton playing a particular role in it. And even then, you know, where you've got people who are reading widely and continuously in the field, we regularly come across stuff where people will say, hey, I really love this story. And everybody will go, well, we haven't even read it. And now we have to, you know, go back, see if we can get some kind of commonality because somebody, you know, most people didn't happen to read the first issue of Interzone of the Year, maybe, or they missed reading, you know, this Kickstarter anthology or this, you know, or I think there was a series of chapbooks that came out in the UK last year that Pat Cadigan wrote a terrific story for, and Mike Harrison wrote for as well, and yet they're barely spoken about, you know. And if Mike Harrison and Pat Cadigan aren't getting people's attention,
yeah,
what chance is anybody else, you know?
Yeah, no, you know? That's frighteningly true, man. And look at the thing that was going through my mind while you were saying that was the fact that Clockwork Phoenix managed to, you know, has managed to flounder in, I want to say, relative obscurity. And when you look at just the slate of authors that have been in there, and the fact that very few stories, if any, that have been in there have been nominated for anything.
Right.
You know, really, it really, you know, calls home the point of, just plain old visibility, especially when you see things like, you know, like a special edition, or you see something that's only going to be coming through Kickstarter and stuff like that, or that's only going to be available through certain venues. It can be tough. Sure. I mean, you're talking to three guys who will read an anthology that's put in front of them. They can smell one in the room if somebody brings it in. And you know, even when I, you know, discover an anthology, you know, after the fact, and I'll hop on it. Like a lot of the Mike Ashby stuff that I've read, and a lot of even hell, I mentioned Godlike Machines. Even that, I don't think I actually found a copy of that because I wasn't part of the book club. I didn't find a copy of that until about a year later.
Sure. What's interesting hearing Jonathan talk about this is that thinking about the sort of saturation point we're at now causes people to react in ways they might not have in previous iterations of the market. So some people just go to the places they trust and that's it. And some of them will just shop around and sort of scan around very vaguely and then lock on to particular things here and there, very scattershot. But I think most people are probably settling into sort of the comfortable places to go. They choose their magazines, they choose their editors, and they don't look at the broader field as much because it's hard. I mean, we're so oversaturated. There's so many stories out there. I mean, we were talking about Daily SF before we started recording, and you know, we're at the point now where there's a website that every single day has a science fiction story,
yeah,
a brand new story. That's stories right there, you know.
Well, I mean, you think about it. If you had, I mean, between Asimov's Analog and FNSF, they're putting out a couple hundred stories a year, something like that. And then you have another one venue comes along that puts out that many stories by itself. Yeah. And then other places like Tor.com, since they added Alan Datlow and Vandermeer to their editorial staff, radically increased the number of stories they're producing. I mean, to everybody's benefit, because that they're at the top of the market and have some spectacularly good stories there because they're very talented editors. But still, here's more. And you turn around and everybody seems to be doing another anthology. And you're going, well, you know, have you read Kaleidoscope, which is the 12th Planet Press YA anthology that looks really good? Are you familiar with Long Hidden, which is this speculative fiction from the margins of history anthology, which I think was kickstarted and which you could easily overlook? I've never seen a copy of Fearful Symmetries, which is the latest Ellen Datlow book that's come out from Cheezine. I mean, I've got a PDF of it, but I mean a physical copy. And that was a kickstarted project full of some terrific writers. It's really easy to suddenly turn and go, well, hang on. I mean, like, have you guys seen Starship Century, for example?
Yes.
But it's not easy to come across.
No, it is.
And we're now waiting for, what is it, the Neal Stephenson thingy project anthology that's coming out later.
Right, yeah, who knows?
Coming out later in the year.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Which would be another, you know, that kind of thing that Catherine Kramer, I think, has worked on as well.
And it's funny that that intro to Fearful Symmetries, they talk about the fact that only a few slots that were in that book were going to be made available for open submission. And even then, they were inundated.
Mm.
And the first level readers, I think they only handed her like it was like under 200 stories that they gave her for like the five slots that ended up getting filled. So,
yeah.
But I also think it can cut both ways with new readers, because for some, you know, if somebody wants to start reading science fiction, they can look at it and it's almost like when I first started getting into Frank Zappa, and it's like, my God, he has thousands of albums. You know, you realize you're never going to be a completist. But at the same time, it like you said, it opens up the door for the fact that you can have, you know, niches, you know, that didn't exist, you know, back when we started reading this stuff. You know, if you're into a specific flavor of story, it's out there, you know. So.
Oh, yeah. But there is a corollary issue out there, and that is that the marketplace is becoming more difficult for all books, so these books are all selling fewer copies.
Right.
They're all making less money, which means that they're paying authors less well than we all would hope they would get paid. You know, you would love to think that some of our top short fiction writers could make a living off it. You know, that Michael Swanwick could really afford to write, you know, and only write as he chose to, or that Jim Kelly, you know, could do the same kind of thing. But these days, when anthologies sell such modest numbers, it's very, very difficult. And there's a real pressure to have the same group of people in books because, you know, they garner an audience.
Right.
And I know that, for example, in the last 6 or 12 months, CIFWA increased its basically professional rate from, I think, 5 to 6 cents a word. And ideally, you know, sort of most markets would be looking to pay 7 to 10 cents a word if they can, or more, particularly somewhere like Tor.com does. But quite often, you know, generating the sales aren't there. And when you get down towards the more Kickstarter level of projects and ones that aren't that solidly funded, writers are sometimes getting paid a real token amount for their work, which is a real problem and a real issue going forward.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, Fred, where do you want to go next?
Well, I think we've definitely covered anthologies and short stories. So perhaps on to our usual, what we've been reading, watching, listening to.
Sure.
Culture.
And who would like to start?
Oh, I'll go.
Oh, yay.
Yeah. a couple things comic-wise. Mark Waid and Kitson brought back Empire, their miniseries from a while ago. They've been doing a multi-part digital-only serialized book, which is unique because it is oriented widescreen for digital readers. And it's been kind of fun. It basically tells this little vignette about Golgotha, the emperor that takes over the world. And it's been pretty neat. And I just discovered yesterday that Chuck Dixon and Larry Stroman brought Alien Legion back, and there's a new issue of a new Alien Legion series that I read and is really good. Also, since last we spoke, we saw the first issue of The Wicked and the Divine by Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey, which is about the strange manifestations of modern gods that appear in pop culture. Really good book. First issue was a nice taste. And the other first issue of note, which needs to be brought up, if anybody read the Doctor Who Star Trek Next Generation crossover from a couple years ago, the same team that did that has just put out their adaptation of Harlan Ellison's original script for City on the Edge of Forever. And the art has a very painted vibe to it. and it pretty much contains just about every piece of dialogue from the script. The only problem with it is that I think it's being written for a collection, so the issue itself doesn't really have an end. Action sort of comes to the end of a page and to be continued. But that's to be expected for a lot of stories like this that are happening. But the first issue of that came out. And I highly recommend it. And the other thing I wanted to mention... Oh, and I'm almost done with my reread of the first book of Ports of Call by Jack Vance, which I probably haven't touched in about 15 years, and which I forgot how thoroughly enjoyable it was.
Ah, excellent.
Okay, John or Jonathan?
I'll go next. Why not? I'll try to keep it brief. I've actually already talked about a lot of the stuff I've read.
True.
Since the last podcast. But a couple other things. I finished City of Stairs by Robert Jackson Bennett.
I hate you.
Which is fan freaking tastic.
I hate you.
Ha ha ha. It's I don't know if it's his best, but it's certainly up there. It's very well written. It's got great characters. It moves along quite well. I mean, it's got all of the stuff that he is strong with appears in full flower in the book. And it's a lot of fun to read too. The only complaint I have with it is that it's a little hard to pin down the world. And what I mean by that is, it paints a very clear picture of sort of the events and the politics of the world, but what the world actually looks like felt a little lacking to me.
Yeah.
I kind of eventually made it up in my head to some extent.
Yeah.
But it's like because it opens in a way that sounds like it might be that. I mean, it's a fantasy novel, and it's secondary world fantasy, but it's in a world that also has trains and cars and other stuff like that. And you're trying to picture what is it, are we talking like 1950s, 1920s, the future? It's hard to tell. But it's a great book. That's also something that I have a lot of reviews to write before I go in for surgery in a couple of weeks. And I'm just very impressed by Bennett and what he can do with a novel. It's really quite something. What else have I read? I read finished Karen Burnham's Masters of Science Fiction series book on Greg Egan, which was good. It gets a little bogged down in a few spots, but I think you're talking about Greg Egan, so it's not going to be a walk in the park to discuss his work. I think she does a very able job. Like I said, I think I said this previously when I had first started reading it. What she does do is she makes you want to read Greg Egan. You finish the book and go, this guy sounds like someone who's never read Greg Egan. I'll admit to that freely right now, and it would be good to go read some, I think, at some point. And also Jed Smith's Masters of Science Fiction series book on John Brunner, I'm working through. That is also good. I think Brunner's a little easier to talk about than Egan, so I think Smith has a different row to hoe with that one, but I'm liking that so far. I've been rereading some of Kit Reed's short fiction because I was supposed to be at ReaderCon in 2 weeks to be on a panel about her work, and now I can't go to ReaderCon. Unfortunately, I can't make it because of medical stuff. But I'm working on a tribute piece that I'm going to try to put up in my column in SF Signal. I'm reading some of her short fiction. And being reminded what a great short fiction author she is, and how I think underappreciated she is in the genre, because she is, as she herself self-characterizes it, she's sort of a trans-genre writer. And the thing that makes it, I think, so hard to pin down is it's so effortless, like it's so seamlessly integrated into the story. It's such an integral part of the story to have whatever fantastic elements are there, and yet they're so, in some ways, unobtrusive. And so organic to the story that you just don't, you kind of go, oh yeah, this is a story about someone who's a pyrokinetic, but that's just part of the person's life. So I've just been rereading that and really appreciating what a great writer she is. And and what interesting things she can do, and how she pushes boundaries, but she's not forcing them. You know, she will push a boundary, she'll go past a boundary, but you don't feel like she's trying to force it or she's trying to flaunt it. It's just, that's where the story has to go, and that's what needs to happen in the story, and that's what the story's about, and that's where it goes. And I think too often there's too much self-consciousness about genre tropes and boundaries. But for her, that seems completely lacking, and that's great to see. And I haven't... Oh, I read a lot of comics, but we're going to talk about those next time, because I didn't get the memo. I'm reading a lot of Guardians of the Galaxy comics in preparation for what is now going to be a future show.
Sorry.
No, that's fine. It's, you know, I think I may have said this before on this podcast or you know, social media. I am, like, one of my favorite things in the world is the Marvel wacky space universe.
Yes.
Like, in terms of, you know, guilty or not guilty pleasures, the Marvel space universe is hilariously fun.
Yeah.
And it's been so much fun to go back through, even when they're not that great. They're still highly entertaining.
Yes, they are.
You know, and I actually want to go back and reread the old Guardian stuff now. I read all the new Guardian stuff and a few things I hadn't read yet. And now I want to go back to the old stuff. And
the original lineup's getting a new book, too.
Yes, I saw that. I just saw that. Yeah. Yep, exactly.
So, yes.
That's always fun. That stuff's just always a lot of fun to read. And I think that's about it for what I have consumed. Yes, that will do. Who's next?
Well, guest or the third horse?
I always love hearing what guests have read, so.
Okay,
well, I've read some comics lately. I've just finished reading the first, you know, the first five-story arc of Ms. Marvel, which is G. Willow Wilson's reimagining of the Captain Marvel character, I guess, as a young Muslim woman, which is really interesting. It drags a little because there's a lot of backstory, a lot of focus on the cultural background of the character to give it context going forward, but it really does pick up, and I think is worth checking out. Warren Ellis has a terrific new series out called Trees.
Oh, yes.
Which is really intriguing. It's only two issues in, but it's already started well. I've been reading and really impressed by Scott Snyder and Sean Murphy's The Wake, which is a post-apocalyptic USA sort of below sea level. It's been overrun by corrupt leaders who are afraid of these horrific kind of super mermaid kind of characters, which sounds really cheesy, but particularly the first five issues is really great. And I've been reading East of West, which is a Jonathan Hickman's dark... Yeah, the Return of Death, which is really good. So those are the comics I've been reading. Novel-wise, I've been just finished The Mirror Empire, which is Cameron Hurley's new book,
which is
very good, yeah. And I really like that. It's a sort of epic fantasy, I guess you'd call it. First volume in a new series, worth looking at. Echopraxia by Peter Watson, just started reading.
You too. I hate everybody.
Very rarely NetGalley is your friend.
Yeah,
and not often, but sometimes.
Yeah,
and
sometimes.
Really, really knocked out by that. I think that's got a lot going for it. The other two things I've read recently are, I just finished last week, Academic Exercises by K.J. Parker.
Ooh.
Ooh.
Which is I've got a galley of. I think the book itself is due out in the next 3 or 4 weeks, I think, and features some just excellent. Short and longish short fiction, and I think stands a jolly good chance of being the best collection of the year. I would also recommend Nick Harkaway's Tiger Man, which I like very much. And what else? That's about it. I've sort of took the kids off to see How to Train Your Dragon 2, but I'm not sure that really falls within our remit. Sorry. and some junky television, but nothing that really sort of covers. So yeah, that's really it. You know, I'm waiting to read Sybil Le Bern, which is the new James Corey, which is out.
Yeah,
that looks like a lot of fun. But I've got to fit that in amongst about 32 anthologies that I currently have to read. So,
okay. All right, and to finish it off, on the family end, my daughter read Vandermeer's Wonder Book, And my wife is reading Annihilation by Vandermeer.
Ah.
And my daughter over the
Vandermeer.
Yeah, keep it in the family. My daughter has managed to watch somehow or rewatch all of the new Doctor Who from
Chris.
Oh,
Eccleston.
Yeah, Chris Eccleston onwards.
Yep.
In about 3 weeks.
Wow.
Hardcore.
Wow.
She is. She's bigger Who fan than I am at this point. I'm getting ready to run a role-playing game for the first time in, well, since she was born, Call of Cthulhu. Reading, to ignore most of the comics, I've reread Atlantis, Three Tales by Samuel R. Delaney, because it was discovered he was black, and I was in such a state of shock I had to read one of his books. To David Drake, since the 10th book of the series, the Leary series, I'm in it, so I want to get up to that point again. Haven't gotten to that point yet. And then I've read Trees, which I agree is very good. It reminds me very much of Mobius.
Yeah.
I'm reading Transmetropolitan.
Fine, I'll go read Trees.
Sorry. Transmetropolitan. Hey, it's only because of you two guys that I started reading Warren Ellis, so, you know, blame yourself. Since we decided upon this theme, I have read Life on Mars, Engineering Infinity, Reach for Infinity.
Wow.
And I am at least 50% or better through Edge Infinity, The Starry Rift.
Oh, God.
The best science fiction fantasy of the year, number 8.
Yep.
By some guy named Strawn. And a couple other collections I've started, but haven't gotten that far, is The Future's Japanese, Kaiju Rising, Arc Volume 1, which is another online magazine. 12 Tomorrows, Space Opera, the latest one called that, which has, I think, Elizabeth Baer and a bunch of other people in it.
The Rich Horton book, yeah.
Yep. And I am definitely living in a post-scarcity short story universe.
Yeah.
Because I have gotten through, let me just see here, looking at my blog entry, 493 short stories as of June 29th, 2014.
Oh, my.
Jeepers.
Yeah. You're not human, Fred.
No. Something's odd.
Yeah.
So I would like to once again thank you, Jonathan, for coming on.
It's been my very great pleasure.
We really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Happy to do it.
Well, and hopefully we can get Gary on and talk about academics or something.
I'm sure he would love to do it as well.
Or single malt. One or the other.
I'm still sober. That's what's wrong. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't know. See, I can see the video. Sometimes I'm, you know, sort of not sure just exactly how sober he is during some of these podcasts. But anyway.
I always hear something clinking in the background, and I'm.
That's the bottle of red wine. Yeah.
Yes. So I'm never sure what time of the day you record it for either of you. So it's like, well. Both of them. One of them is drinking.
Much maybe, like this, we yeah.
Maybe they swap.
No. It's very rare that we swap, and it's been very, very strange and uncanny. Whenever we record with a British guest, we have to do it like in the middle of their afternoon, which is Gary's morning and my nighttime, right?
Right.
And that gets very surreal.
Everybody's cranky.
And the weirdest ones, the once or twice when we first recorded one. Face to face, that was also very weird. Well, because we rarely actually are in the same place, you know, ever.
Mm-hmm.
And so, the first time is like, and now here we are, and looking, going, but you're like, you're right there. And up until a while ago, it was all without any video or anything, and you're used to just being completely focused, you know, on the voice you're hearing rather than the person in front of you. If that makes sense.
Well, close your eyes.
Well, that gets rude. And of course, as you guys know, we're going to do one of these live.
Yeah.
One of our ones live, will happen in London. You're going to be there, Fred?
No, I can't afford the travel.
So we've got some friends joining us. We've got no idea how that's going to be. That's going to be quite weird. But I think Bob Silverberg and Stan Robinson and Ooh. Joe Walton are going to join us
Ooh.
For that episode.
Wow. Yeah.
And I think we've got an app. And it might actually be reasonably recorded because the convention are going to record it for us. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we've got like an hour and a half on the program. So it should be a lot of fun to actually get out in front of people. So
as long as you don't put any footage of Doctor Who or...
No, it gets cut.
Yeah. Yeah, you don't want the feed to be interrupted by the copyright dogs.
I ideally not, no. But anyway.
So once,
that's great.
Appreciate it. And I think we've rambled to reuse somebody else's theme for long enough. So thank you all. Hope you enjoyed it as much as we enjoyed
very
recording
much.
It.
Thank you.
And have a good night.
You too. Thank you very Thanks. Much. Okay, bye.
Thanks again.
My pleasure.